split that? Is it because, like, again, it covers more than one aspect of your life, every aspect of your life?
I think every aspect of your
Right?
life for me.
But then again, if that's what lifestyle means, the style of your life is Islamic. Well, isn't that the objective of Islam to begin with? Why do you gotta glue the word lifestyle to it? You're a Muslim, period. Islam is a lifestyle.
Islam is a lifestyle itself, yeah.
Right? Because
The way of life.
if you're Islamic, then you're Islamic, you're in your diet, obviously. We've got very
True.
strict
In
dietary
everything.
standards. You're Islamic in your clothes, you're Islamic in your interaction, you're Islamic in your politics, in your economy.
Whatever you do.
Yes, you're Islamic in your relationships, you're
True.
Islamic in your
Conversations.
conversations, in your child rearing and child upbringing, your education.
Your deeds.
Yeah, because Islam has a set of do's and don'ts for all
True.
of these aspects of your life.
Exactly.
So it already is a lifestyle.
True.
You don't necessarily gotta say Islamic lifestyle.
Yeah.
Just say Islamic.
Yeah, I understand what you're trying to
I
say.
don't know why, it just irks me a little when they say Islamic lifestyle. Islam is a lifestyle. Go get your facts straight.
Maybe they're referring to the lifestyle of Muslims by saying that. Yeah.
Yeah, now I get it. This is why we have these discussions, you guys. How Islamic do you think your lifestyle is? Or how do you think you're having an Islamic lifestyle?
By just working on the do's and don'ts of Islam in all my whatever I do, like the way I even think to the way I act, I think in everything. For example, if you ask me personally, the way I dress up, the way I talk, sometimes I want to be very furious at someone and just not being furious and being patient at
Is
that
the
time,
Islamic lifestyle.
of course. Of course, it tells you like to calm down, to chill,
Be
and
patient.
you know, having good intentions about people. If someone, I get very much irked with this thing, if someone is talking at your back and you get to know.
I don't mind it when people talk behind my back.
No. People talk behind your back or do some anything bad to you. And then we have this very, very beautiful hadith from Imam Ali alayhi salam, who says that give 70 positive assumptions. Maybe.
Yes. And that changes everything. It's such a game changer.
Such a game changer thing. Maybe this person did this thing because of this. We don't even say one maybe to ourselves.
And 70 is like a big number. And
Seven.
excuse you me, but Imam Ali doesn't exaggerate. He's a ma'soom. When he
Yeah.
says 70, he means 70.
He means that. And I think 70 is a great number. We don't even say to ourselves 7 times. We don't give 70
Exactly. Our
positive
first
assumptions.
reaction is that I'm a burn his house down.
Exactly. So I think if we don't even like listen to the person why he did that. Because even if sometimes we'll listen to that, maybe things will change again. But yes, Islamic lifestyle. Islamic lifestyle teaches you the way you should deal with the things, especially the things that can just be more destroying, like this your furiousness, being impatient, being so rebellious, and all. So I think here Islamic lifestyle plays a very key role.
Well, I know a lot of people who aren't Muslims, but they're like that still. Maybe they won't go as far as, 70, but they're still like that. They're just good people. So I'm
Right.
feeling like there has to be something that differentiates, discerns between being just
Totally
a good
Islamic.
person or a good Muslim.
Yeah.
What is it that
Makes you a good Muslim.
What's that specific factor that discerns them, you know, sets them apart? A person who's just a good person and a person who's a good Muslim.
What differentiates them?
Yes. And I think it's their intention.
Wow.
Al-a'mal bi-niyat. Your actions are based on your intentions.
Intentions.
Right?
Well.
And a good Muslim is all of that and much more with the intention of satisfying Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Well.
Right?
Yes.
But a good person is just that for the sake of being a good person. I'm not undermining it. I'm not lessening its value. I'm not saying it doesn't matter. You're a good person. More power to you. Kudos to you. I'm totally supporting that. I'm totally for that. I mean,
but
for
the
reals.
Intention of a good Muslim differs.
It differs. And
he is doing that with the intention of doing it for Allah.
And I think it's everlasting.
Yeah.
It renders the action utterly eternal.
True.
And a Muslim lifestyle, an Islamic lifestyle, means to have an incorporeal, infinite, eternal mindset toward your existence.
True.
And to understand that whatever you do is not only limited to your life on this planet, and that it has the potential to last forever. You guys are listening to Youth Station here on IRB English Radio. We're going to be back after a short break, so stay with us.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
How do you think personally you are Islamic?
If I could rate myself on a scale of 1 to 10, I would say...
No, in terms of your actions. I don't want you to scale yourself. Mm. Like, scaling or judging is the job of the...
Creator.
Themselves. And I just want to know through your deeds, like your actions that you do and that you personally do.
Do I consider myself living an Islamic lifestyle?
True.
See, here's the thing. Because I've had both. I used to have a non-Islamic lifestyle.
Oh.
Right? And then God smacked me in the back of the head and I repented. And now I have this lifestyle.
Wow.
And they were like day and night. So this is how I know how much it's changed. Because I had the non-Islamic lifestyle, and I don't have that, and it was so different from the lifestyle I have now, I can tell that, oh yeah, my lifestyle is pretty Islamic. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because I know what the non-Islamic looks like. I would say, yeah, it's pretty Islamic.
Well, I can see you in front of my eyes right now.
Exactly.
And I can say, in terms of your wearings, in terms of your looks... That's Islamic.
Yeah, that's Islamic enough, right? And I think it shows itself more when you're a woman compared to a man, right?
Yeah.
Because we have got that whole hijab thing going on and men don't. Though I personally believe, based on my studies and research, based on hardcore facts, that men have a degree of hijab too. But
I wish we have this discussion.
Round table debate sort of thing.
Do you think, since you said that you had both the lifestyles. Mm. What do you think is a better part of this?
The best part of having an Islamic lifestyle?
Yeah.
Oh, I would say the sense of meaning and purpose that comes with it. And I'm digging that. I love that so much. And the sense of peace that comes with it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because when you develop the sort of lifestyle for yourself and you give direction and meaning to every aspect of it, based on the doctrine and the principle and the axiom and the ideology that you've adopted, you just feel so much more comfortable with yourself.
True. You know, Zainab, I would want you to tell here for our listeners that most people who think non-Islamic, who live in non-Islamic states and all, they think the people, the youth or, you know, whosoever has Islamic way of life, Islamic lifestyle, it is mostly, you know, based on that follow-up thing. It's something that's got nothing to do with your logic. Like, you have to do it with your logic.
Mm.
That's what I'm trying to say. The people who are non-Islamic, who do not know.
Well, you know, I think that's a very ignorant way of looking at it. Because,
you know, people think that they are blindly following
exactly.
something.
Exactly.
That's what I'm trying to say.
This is what I'm saying. From where I'm standing, it's just it's the same as
because you
referring to a professional.
When I asked you what's the best thing, you mm-hmm. used the line with the purpose and the meaning.
Mm.
The purpose and meaningful acts that you do. With what purpose does your logic support that?
It was totally a logical journey for me.
So?
It was an absolute logical journey because otherwise it wouldn't be sustainable.
Mm-hmm.
If it was just a spur of a moment sort of thing.
Like,
you know,
blind eye following
yeah,
thing.
And like a stir of emotions that occurred, mm-hmm. then it wouldn't last at all.
True.
So it was definitely a logical journey, and it's just a matter of referring to a professional
mm-hmm.
in certain fields that I have. It's just out of my field of expertise.
Mm-hmm.
I do not have the faculty to know the ruling regarding every single thing that happens in life.
True.
The actual, like, jurisprudential ruling of it.
True.
So I refer to an expert.
Yeah.
Like, you refer to a doctor, you refer to a lawyer, you refer to an IT expert or whatever.
I was saying that people think, those who live in non-Islamic states think that we are always in a state of referring, while as we are not. Like, so many times Quran says, go for tafakkarun,
tadabbarun,
you know?
Comprehend and reflect and
exactly.
contemplate and
exactly.
do soul searching. All that is very important. We're so out of time. Thank you so very much for being with us, you guys. This has been Youth Station. On behalf of the cast and crew, I bid you all goodbye and farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
I am what I am because you made. I have what I have. My love is strong because you are the one I call creator, my Alpha and Omega, my protector and my maker. Because of you, in weakness I am braver, my defender and my savior, my giver and my taker. Abiding in silence with patience and guidance, aware when I need you, the light when I seek you, justice, forgiveness, the strength in my weakness, and my love is strong.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight. In the United States, new burdens, low pay, and the pandemic have prompted the resignations of a fifth of the legal workforce in New York City's Manhattan, the Bronx, and Brooklyn. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Jonah Bromwich. The piece is titled, Why Hundreds of New York City Prosecutors Are Leaving Their Jobs. New York City's prosecutors are leaving in droves, citing pandemic burnout, low salaries, and two intersecting laws that fundamentally changed the nature of their jobs. They just simply can't do it anymore, Darcel Clark, the Bronx district attorney, said in a Friday interview. The money is not where it should be, and the work-life balance is just unmanageable. This year alone, 36 have left the Brooklyn district attorney's office, and 44 have left Manhattan district attorney's office. At least 28 have left the Bronx, and the 9 Staten Island assistant district attorneys who have left this year represented about 10% of that office's prosecutorial staff. The Queens office told the New York City Council that it was on track this year to more than double last year's resignations. In the past year, the Manhattan and Brooklyn district attorneys, who have about 500 prosecutors each, lost almost a fifth of that workforce, a sharp increase from attrition averages before 2020. The Bronx is shedding lawyers at a similar pace, a total of 104 since July. The district attorneys are replacing their previous employees when they can, often exchanging experienced prosecutors for untested ones. When the pandemic arrived in New York 2 years ago, it disrupted nearly all court proceedings. At the same time, 2 new state laws took effect governing discovery. The sharing of all evidence, potential evidence, and other case-related material. Prosecutors say the measures, which were intended to make trials fairer to defendants, create onerous amounts of paperwork. The first law requires prosecutors to obtain and hand over hundreds of documents on many cases, a demanding task that can impede interviewing witnesses and otherwise preparing for court. A second law ties the handover of that material to the speedy trial clock, creating deadline pressure for prosecutors to collect all the material once charges are filed. That law is known as Caliph's Law, named for Caliph Broder, a teenager who committed suicide after being held on Rikers Island for 3 years without a trial. For instance, if a defendant blew into a breathalyzer, a defense attorney is entitled to 6 months' worth of calibration reports on that device. Prosecutors also have a continuing obligation to hand over a similar number of calibration reports filed after the defendant used the device. The new laws aren't the only reason for departures. District attorneys say that their city-funded budgets are too thin to allow them to pay prosecutors competitively. Despite the cost of living in Manhattan and Brooklyn, starting salaries for prosecutors in those boroughs is $72,000. In Bronx, it is $75,121. And of course, the trend has coincided with the pandemic, which has caused record numbers of voluntary resignations across all industries. District attorneys say their employees are struggling. Ms. Clark said her office's lawyers, inundated with paperwork, could make $30,000 more doing similar tasks for law firms, which might also let them work from home. Why not do that, she said. State lawmakers rewrote the discovery law in 2019, after defense attorneys said that prosecutors were withholding key evidence. The previous law required them to turn over certain evidence only after defense attorneys had requested it in writing. Because defendants, a disproportionate number of whom are people of color, were not privy to the full scope of the evidence against them, they often accepted plea deals rather than risk going to trial. The defense bar was basically completely in the dark about what the case was even about, said John Bozza, a former prosecutor at the Manhattan District Attorney's Office, who now practices defense law as a partner at Contour, George and Bozza, PC. Public defenders argued that without pressure on prosecutors to turn over exculpatory facts, their clients were perpetually at risk of wrongful conviction. The discovery law changed that. Prosecutors are now obligated to turn over 21 kinds of material, including all electronically created or stored information relevant to a case. Prosecutors now must hustle to obtain reams of paperwork, much of it produced by the New York Police Department and submitted to defense attorneys, or risk seeing a case tossed out. Prosecutors often worked as many as 100 cases simultaneously, and a large percentage of their cases now generate significant paperwork. Ms. Clark said that the workload had led to immense pressure on her assistants, who feel that their cases are going to get dismissed or that I'm going to fire them. When they have all this pressure on them, they'd rather go somewhere else where their quality of life is better, she said. They don't have to work nights, weekends, holidays, and do all this discovery. Caitlin Nolan, an 11-year veteran of the Manhattan District Attorney's Office, said in an interview on Friday that she started looking for a new job last spring amid the challenges of working on a low salary, the everyday difficulties of the pandemic, and frustration with new laws. She left the office in January of this year. It was difficult to comply with because there was so much we were expected to produce, she said, adding that having to provide information about witnesses who would express concern to her about defendants knowing their identities ahead of a trial was particularly nerve-wracking. In recent testimony submitted to the New York City Council, the Manhattan District Attorney, Alvin Bragg, illustrated the burden. He reported that before 2020, his office used about 32 terabytes of data storage. Today, it uses 320 terabytes of data storage, a 900% increase over a period of 2 years. Tina Luongo, the attorney in charge of the criminal defense practice at the Legal Aid Society, said that she agreed that prosecutors and public defenders needed more money for competitive salaries, particularly in the light of the discovery laws. High workloads, even high workloads for public defenders, diminish morale. I'm not going to deny that, she said, adding that she expected the state to provide local prosecutors with tens of millions of dollars for staffing in its coming budget. But she said, it cannot be the case that, and it must not be the case that the way you solve a workload problem is to diminish the rights of somebody accused of a crime.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle.
Today's lesson, meet at the time of return from the trip. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the rights of the neighbors and meeting them at the time of return from the trip. According to the Islamic teachings, it is necessary to pay attention to the rights of the neighbors And due to the importance that the neighbors have in the Islamic teachings, obviously we must take care of their rights. One of the rights of the neighbors, according to the Islamic teachings, is that we must meet them at the time of return from the trip or a journey. And obviously we know that people, when they go for a trip or a journey, maybe they are having a good time at that trip, or maybe they are having a bad time in that trip. And on top of that, when someone goes to the journey, obviously maybe they had no issues, or maybe they had issues in their traveling. So when they're coming back, it is necessary to go and visiting them, to meet them, to ask about their journey, to know how the journey was, and to be aware of their financial position as well. Maybe someone has gone to a specific trip, and there he was in need of money, and he maybe had taken a loan from someone, and after that he is in need. So basically, when we are going and visiting our neighbors, and when we are asking about their trip, or maybe we just generally going and meeting, maybe they are discussing their issues with us, or maybe they are sharing the experience that they had in there. And this experience can also help us in our life as well, for example, if we want to have a trip. So it is necessary to go and meet them when they are coming back from a trip. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of meeting the neighbors at the time of return from the trip. In the Islamic lifestyle, we see that the teachings of Islam tells us that if you want to have a proper Islamic lifestyle, you need to give importance to the rights of the neighbors. And therefore, Imam Zainul Abidin has said that وَتَأَحْهُدِ قَادِمِهِمْ, that you must go and see them when they're coming back from a trip, when they're coming back from a journey. We know that in the past, people used to have, they used to travel and it was a long way. They were traveling maybe by walk or maybe by horses. But in today's world, there are the planes, cars, and there are other means, trains, for example. But obviously, even in today's world, it is necessary to go and visiting the neighbors when they're coming back from a trip, so that we know about them, we can be sure about their health position, health status, or maybe the financial, or maybe if they have a need and they shy to go and say to their neighbors or to share with someone. When someone is going there and visiting them by himself, therefore they might open their issues, or they might ask for the help if they are in a specific need. And it is also ethical that when someone goes to a trip for a specific days, for maybe for 3 days or a month or a week, when he's coming back, we go and visit them. That in a case that even there was no issue and they had a good trip, because they were away for a couple of days and we were unable to see them in these days, therefore we go and ethically, we go and we meet them. It is ethical to see them and to wish them or to welcome them that they are back home. So these are the ethical things that we must perform, and we must take care of our neighbors, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
in the limelight.
Politicians catering to the extremely wealthy at the expense of the 140 million Americans who are poor or low income is precisely what made the pandemic so deadly, says Dr. William J. Barber, researcher, in an article published under the heading 1 million American COVID-19 deaths is a searing indictment of poverty and policy choices. Stay tuned for more. The U.S. has now reached the once unthinkable toll of 1 million deaths from COVID-19. How could this happen in the wealthiest country in the world? In a word, because of poverty and the policy choices that perpetuate it. The task now is to make different choices. Americans across the country have suffered during this pandemic, but new research by the Poor People's Campaign strongly suggests the poor and low income have suffered the most. Even controlling for vaccination rates, they found that COVID-19 death rates in poorer U.S. counties were nearly double those in wealthier counties. During the deadliest phases of the pandemic, it rose to 5 times as many. White Americans still make up the largest share of America's poor and those who have died from COVID-19, but Black, Hispanic, and Indigenous Americans are significantly overrepresented in America's poorest counties, and COVID-19 casualty rates run significantly higher for many communities of color. Poor Americans are hit hardest for many reasons. Since they make up a large share of low-wage frontline workers, they are more exposed to the virus and often lack paid sick leave if they contract it. They're also more likely to lack health insurance and suffer from pre-existing conditions. But it's not just that the poor have suffered. Equally important is that the very richest Americans have seen their wealth skyrocket. As of this May, America's billionaires' collective wealth had ballooned by $1.7 trillion since the pandemic began, according to the Institute for Policy Studies, IPS, and Americans for Tax Fairness. Elon Musk alone saw his wealth increase more than tenfold. That's not all. In 2020, more than half of America's largest low-wage employers bent the rules to give CEOs enormous pay raises, even as their essential workers suffered cuts. On average, CEOs at these firms made over $15 million, more than what their median employees would make in 8 centuries. And now those who have benefited the most from this pandemic are trying to pull the rug out from those who have suffered the worst. They're spending big to undo some of the most important public policies the United States has seen in generations. President Joe Biden's American Rescue Plan made testing and vaccines nearly universally accessible. It also delivered stimulus payments, expanded unemployment insurance, made the child tax credit more generous, and increased assistance for everything from food to health insurance. These life-saving provisions got hundreds of millions of Americans vaccinated and helped millions more weather an extremely difficult time. The expanded child tax credit alone reduced child poverty by 30%, stunning, if incomplete, achievements. But billionaires, executives, and corporations who have seen their fortunes flourish have poured money into the campaign coffers of politicians who oppose these measures. When Democrat Joe Manchin joined every Senate Republican in opposing the renewal and expansion of these programs and was showered with campaign cash in return, they withered on the vine. Now, U.S. child poverty has surged, rising wages have failed to keep up with inflation, and millions are at risk of losing their health insurance. So far, Congress has even failed to continue funding COVID-19 research, vaccines, and testing. Politicians catering to the extremely wealthy at the expense of the 140 million Americans who are poor or low income is precisely what made the pandemic so deadly in the first place. We shouldn't compound the tragedy of 1 million COVID-19 deaths by letting it continue. With midterm looming, Congress should act quickly to pass a billionaire's tax and a windfall tax on pandemic profits, especially on industries like oil companies that keep hiking their prices. Lawmakers could use this money to help families meet their basic needs. Congress should also support COVID-19 vaccination efforts at home and abroad to prevent both needless suffering and new COVID-19 variants. Even if Congress won't act, President Biden should do it. He can issue executive actions to relieve student loan debt for 43 million borrowers, lower prescription drug costs, give workers raises by increasing the overtime eligibility threshold, and make it harder for companies with obscene CEO worker pay gaps to get federal contracts. This pandemic has caused almost incomprehensible loss in the United States of America. One thing Americans must never lose is their determination to treat its pre-existing conditions.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghodde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of the speech delivered on April 29, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of Quds Day. In the first part of this speech, Imam Khamenei expressed his gratitude for the Iranian nation for their participation in Quds Day. Even though the Zionist regime is out of breath It continues to commit crimes and kill innocent people with its weapons. It murders unarmed women, children, the elderly and the youth. It imprisons and tortures them, destroys houses and demolishes farms and property. The liars in European and the US who make extravagant claims about human rights and who created a commotion on the issue of Ukraine keep totally silent in the face of all these crimes in Palestine. Not only do they not defend the innocent people, they also help that bloodthirsty wolf. This is an important lesson regarding the issue of the world of Islam, at the top of which stands the issue of Palestine. We cannot and must not rely on these racist, hostile powers. Only with a power that comes from resistance, which originates in the teachings of the Quran and which arises from the religious rulings of Dear Islam, can one resolve the issue of the world of Islam and the issue of Palestine, which stands at the top of all Islamic issues.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The formation of the resistance in West Asia has been the most blessed phenomenon in this region in recent decades. It was the magnificence of the resistance that was able to cleanse the occupied territories of Lebanon of the pollution of the Zionists, pull Iraq out from the clutches of the US, save Iraq from the maliciousness of the Daesh, ISIS, and assist Syrian defenders in the face of the US schemes. The resistance fights against international terrorism helps the resistant people of Yemen in the war that has been imposed on them, wrestles with the Zionist usurpers in Palestine, and will bring them to their knees with God's grace. It also highlights the issue of Quds and Palestine more and more for the people of the world to see on a daily basis. You people of Palestine, you self-sacrificing youth in the West Bank and in the 1948 lands, you who are struggling for God in the Jenin refugee camp, and you, the residents in the Palestinian camps outside of Palestine, are important, sensitive parts and pioneers of the resistance.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
In the limelight.
In view of the fast-paced developments around the world, it is still not too late for Finland and Sweden to withdraw their requests to join NATO, and like Hungary and several other European countries, strive to forge friendly relations with Russia, which, after all, unlike the US, is a fellow European country. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Kayhan International Staff Writer. This article is published under the heading Are Finland and Sweden on suicidal course to join NATO? Stay tuned for more. The recently released photo of U.S. President Joe Biden addressing a press conference in Washington, flanked on his right side by Finland's President Sauli Niinistö and on his left side by Sweden's Prime Minister Magdalena Andersson, presents a pathetic picture. It appears as if an ailing emperor, not in command of his senses and completely unaware of the words he is uttering, has summoned to his court two rulers of some remote lands willing to submit to his yoke on the assumption that alignment with an empire, although a tottering one, might be in the interest of their people more than the peace and prosperity that neutrality has brought over the past century. The Swedes and the Finns seem to be ignorant of realities, especially the evil nature of the United States of America, which is playing a dangerous game and doesn't care about their security and sovereignty. As a matter of fact, the U.S. is totally unconcerned about the stability of all of Europe, except perhaps the fellow English-speaking islanders of Britain, and is using the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, which Finland and Sweden want to join, as an instrument of its hegemonic hold on the European Union. As could be clear by the war into which the U.S. has pushed Ukraine as part of its bid to weaken traditional rival Russia, it will never hesitate to sacrifice the two hitherto neutral Nordic countries on the altar of its extraterritorial ambitions. And this fact was crystal clear at the recent press conference in Washington, where Biden's words belittling Finland and Sweden, even if they join NATO, could not be properly grasped by his two Scandinavian hosts because of their unfamiliarity with the English language. He spoke of a vague bottom line and said, "An enlarged and a strong NATO is the foundation of U.S. security." In other words, the U.S. president meant to say that he is the least concerned if Europe is destroyed and the European people plunged into death and destruction, in order to ensure that the U.S. remains the sole superpower as a result of possible damage a war on several fronts could inflict upon Russia's economy, industries, agriculture, and political power, and indirectly on the emerging world power, China, if it aligns itself with Moscow. A satanic game plan indeed by the United States, but Russia's President Vladimir Putin seems to have his own plans. His preemptive military operation on Ukraine to thwart the bid by the Zionist Volodymyr Zelensky to put the NATO yoke on a Slavic country is not only a warning to Finland and Sweden to avoid Washington's bait, but has begun to put a strain on the U.S. military and financial resources. This is clear by the tens of billions of dollars of U.S. money going to waste in Ukraine, along with the destruction of the massive flow of weapons into that country by the Russian army. Following Putin's stark warning of possible military measures if the Nordic countries become a party to NATO's eastward expansion towards the Russian borders, Russia's Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu said, without elaborating, we are taking adequate countermeasures. Moscow's Gazprom has already served notice to Finland to cut the gas link, catching Helsinki off guard, and could be a prelude to stronger measures in the Baltic Sea. In view of these fast-paced developments, it is still not too late for Finland and Sweden to withdraw their request to join NATO. Unlike Hungary and several other European countries, strive to forge friendly relations with Russia, which after all, unlike the US, is a fellow European country.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Outrage has spread across the pro-Palestine community this week after British Home Secretary Priti Patel branded the boycott, divestment and sanctions movement racist and anti-Semitic. The controversial comments were issued on Monday at a Conservative Friends of Israel lobby group event.
The BDS movement, everything we have seen around the BDS movement is racist. The anti-Semitic troops, the cartoons, the chants.
Founded in 2005, the BDS movement is a Palestinian-led campaign promoting boycott and economic sanctions against Israel. After a notable rise in popularity and success in recent years, the British establishment has acted to essentially criminalise the practice. In response to Patel's comments, onlookers have pointed out her own policies and praise of Israel's ambassador as blatant hypocrisy.
The hypocrisy of Priti Patel calling anyone or anything racist on one hand, whilst openly gushing for Tzipi Hotovli on the other. I mean, Tzipi is an out-and-out anti-Arab racist. She thinks that Jews and Arabs should have no relationships at all. She also thinks that the Nakba, the expulsion of 700,000 Palestinians at the birth of Israel, she thinks that was a myth. Secondly, Priti Patel herself, her comments against Black Lives Matter, against English footballers who took the knee against in solidarity against racism, and also the laws that she's brought into place, like the Nationality and Borders Act. These comments, these laws, they've further, deeper, structuralised racism into British society.
In addition to the anti-BDS remarks, Patel laid bare her so-called unflinching support to Israel. This comes just days after the shock killing of Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akhila by Israeli regime forces, making it appear that no matter what crimes are being committed, Tel Aviv can rely on unwavering support from the British Home Office. Robert Carter, London.
On Friday, about 2,000 people staged a rally in the Italian capital calling on the Mario Draghi government and the EU to stop sending weapons to Kyiv and finally promote peace talks to resolve the war in Ukraine. The initiative had been called by a number of base unions and supported by a string of leftist movements. People at the rally expressed high concern over the serious military escalation by all parties involved in the Ukraine conflict.
The EU is not acting right. Its wary posture has only put one bloc against another. The people are those who will suffer from our rulers' decisions in the end.
There are too many conflicting interests at stake, and Italy is far too servile. The EU should do more. I don't support Putin, but I'm also against Zelensky. He is not acting in the interests of the Ukrainians.
Following the start of the conflict in Ukraine, Italy has opted to gradually cut its gas reliance on Russia, Rome has been importing gas from Moscow for over 50 years, and about 45% of its total demand is provided by Russia.
I'm a small retailer. I was forced to close down during the COVID, but I haven't seen a cent of support from the government. And now they spend billions for the war. When will they look after us?
Undoubtedly, the Italian government is far too aligned with NATO, but it's not just that. The government is very much distant from the people, as surveys show the majority of the Italians are against the war.
Since the start of the conflict, opinion polls have steadily shown half of the Italians oppose the sending of weapons to Ukraine and believe sanctions against Russia are useless. About one-fifth of the surveyed Italians have so far said they are in support of the Draghi government's delivery of heavy weapons to Kyiv.
The conflict in Ukraine, its dire consequences and the fear it could spread or go on for a long time are not the only worries Italians are concerned with. Rising inflation, a growing cost of energy, blocked salaries, continual crumbling of purchasing power, all economic indicators are pointing towards a recession. Many expect the country to be faced with a hot autumn of strikes and protests. Max Civili, Rome.
A UK-based Israeli arms manufacturer has been hit with a series of disruptive direct action protests in retaliation to recent Israeli aggression against Palestinians. Palestine Action have intensified their long-running campaign against Elbit Systems, with activists trashing sites in London and Bristol.
Elbit Systems is a notorious Israeli arms manufacturer with locations dotted all across the UK. Their HQ, located just behind me, is a popular target for Palestine Action, who claim that their activities is focused on disrupting their production activities. Elbit is known for producing up to 85% of Israel's drone fleet, after all.
Israeli crimes against Palestinians has circulated world headlines in recent weeks, particularly surrounding the killing of journalist Shireen Abu Akhila, shot dead by Israeli regime forces as she documented an Israeli assault on a Palestinian refugee camp on the 11th of May. The killing occurred just days before the Nakba, an annual date which marks the ethnic cleansing of native Palestinians from their homeland. Elbit's recent response stated,
Elbit Systems UK is proud to provide advanced support for the UK armed forces. Attempting to disrupt this work during a time of heightened global instability is dangerous and highly irresponsible.
However, speaking to Press TV, the activists rubbish Elbit's stance.
How many lives have they saved compared to how many lives they've taken, would be my question. They are responsible for so many deaths of men, women and children. How could you possibly think that that's in any way security? It's illegal, it's a crime. All of these things are criminal, and yet it's when you're out there doing something that you're shown as the criminal, essentially. And I've always found that very interesting as a narrative.
With Palestine Action vowing to continue and Israel's occupation persisting, many expect to see more spilling of red paint, but also more Palestinian blood too. Robert Carter, London.
Once again, crimes committed by the Israeli regime have been debated in the European Parliament. Lawmakers condemned the brutal murder on the 11th of May of Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akhla. She was shot in the head by an Israeli soldier.
Too often we, here in Europe, look away when the spiral of violence continues, when new settlements plans are announced, or when another journalist gets killed or wounded.
Clearly wearing press attire, 51-year-old Abu Akhla was murdered in cold blood while covering an Israeli military raid in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin. During her funeral, Israeli forces attacked mourners.
The European Union is appalled by the events that took place during the funeral procession. The EU condemned this disproportionate use of force and the disrespectful behaviour.
Western media and Western leaders have been accused of turning a blind eye to the international law violations.